Before sugar ruled the world, it ruled these islands. Fields were not planted to feed people. They were planted to feed empires. Every acre cleared in Jamaica, Barbados, Saint Domingue, and later Cuba answered a single question asked in European boardrooms and royal courts. How much profit can land produce if human life is treated as fuel? This was not accidental. It was engineered. Sugar demanded scale, speed, and control. It demanded bodies that could be worked to exhaustion and replaced without pause. Law bent to protect it. Violence organized itself around it. Governments were built to serve it. We are not starting with rebellion or freedom. We are starting with design. The cold decisions that turned tropical soil into an industrial machine and people into inputs. This is where the modern Caribbean begins, not in culture or nationhood, but in extraction. To understand what came after, we have to face what was built first and who it was built for. Chapter 1. The sugar machine is built. The story does not begin with chains. It begins with appetite. In 17th century Europe, sugar shifts from rarity to obsession. What was once a luxury for the elite becomes a mass demand tied to tea, coffee, and rising urban life. That demand does not look to Europe for supply. It looks south and west, to land taken by force and redesigned for profit. The Caribbean becomes the answer. Barbados is the first experiment that works too well. Early English settlers try small farming. Tobacco, cotton, mixed crops. None deliver the returns investors want. Sugar does. But sugar is not a crop you grow, it is a system you build. Plantation owners clear the island fast. Forests fall. Watersheds are disrupted. Land that once held diverse life is reduced to single use. Cane from edge to edge, mills near fields, roads built only to move harvest to port. Everything points outward, never inward. Sugar demands labor at a scale the island cannot supply. Indigenous people are already dead or displaced. European indentured servants do not last. They die too quickly or demand freedom. The solution is imported. Enslaved Africans, purchased in bulk, forced into total submission, and worked under a logic that treats death as acceptable loss. This is where the machine takes shape. Plantations are not communities, they are factories. Time is measured by output. Bodies are measured by endurance. If a worker collapses, another can be bought. The system does not slow, it accelerates. Colonial law adjusts to protect this design. Codes define who is property and who is human. Violence becomes legal structure. Punishment is not personal, it is procedural. Control is maintained not by fear alone, but by certainty. There is no appeal. There is no exit. Barbados becomes a model colony. Investors watch closely. Governors report profits. Sugar proves it can fund fleets, finance wars, and stabilize crowns. Other powers take note. When England captures Jamaica from Spain in the mid-17th century, it does not improvise. It copies. Planters from Barbados arrive with experience and capital. Jamaica is larger, more fertile, more dangerous. The same system is scaled up. Land seizures expand fast. Maroon communities resist from the interior, but the coast becomes cane, mills multiply, ports are fortified. The island is re-engineered not as a society, but as a supply node. Governance bends again. Colonial assemblies are dominated by planters. Laws are written by those who profit most from brutality. Tax policy favors export. Defense spending protects plantations, not people. The island's purpose is clear and enforced. This is not chaos, it is order. Sugar plantations require precision. Cutting schedules, boiling cycles, shipping windows. Enslaved laborers are worked around the clock during harvest. Injury is expected. Death is accounted for. New shipments are planned in advance. The plantation economy does not see cruelty as failure. It sees inefficiency as failure. Any measure that increases yield is justified. Any loss that does not disrupt profit is tolerated. Across the Caribbean, the pattern spreads. European powers refine their methods. Insurance markets grow around human cargo. Credit systems are built on future harvests. Sugar is traded before it is grown. Enslaved people are mortgaged before they arrive. This is how sugar transforms from agriculture into finance. The Caribbean islands become locked into this role. Food for local consumption declines. Dependency grows. Imports increase. The enslaved population grows faster than the free population, creating constant fear among planters, answered with harsher controls. Race hardens into policy. Difference is weaponized. Division is deliberate. The system cannot survive unity among the exploited. We need to be clear about this moment. Nothing about this outcome is accidental. The violence is not excess, it is the fuel. Sugar does not tolerate moderation, it rewards domination. By the early 1800s, sugar money flows through European cities. Ports expand, banks rise, factories hum. The wealth looks clean by the time it reaches London, Paris, and Madrid. The blood is already absorbed by the soil. In the Caribbean, the cost is visible everywhere. Landscapes are stripped, families are erased. Time itself is owned by someone else. And yet, from the perspective of empire, the system works. Sugar is cheap, profits are high, resistance is crushed, the machine runs. But machines built this way carry a flaw. They cannot adjust, they cannot soften, they cannot survive change. By the start of the 19th century, the Caribbean sugar system has become too big to reform and too violent to endure. Every acre, every law, every ship is tied to forced labor. There is no alternative economy ready to take its place. Sugar is no longer just a crop, it is an empire's spine, and a spine built on human exhaustion cannot bend forever. Chapter 2: Profit at Any Human Cost. By the 18th century, the sugar machine is no longer experimental. It is mature, efficient, and merciless. European demand keeps rising. Tea tables multiply, coffee houses spread. Sugar is no longer a luxury, it is an expectation. That expectation presses directly on the Caribbean, tightening every lever already in place. The transatlantic slave trade expands to meet it. Ships arrive with human cargo packed for survival, not health. Traders plan for loss before departure. Mortality is factored into price. Insurance absorbs the rest. What matters is delivery volume, not condition. The plantation will finish the work. On the islands, accounting books reduce people to columns. Age, strength, purchase cost, expected lifespan, replacement timing. This is not metaphor, this is documentation. Plantation records treat human beings as depreciating assets. Barbados reaches a breaking imbalance. Enslaved Africans vastly outnumber Europeans. The island becomes a place of permanent fear for the ruling class. That fear does not soften behavior, it sharpens it. Surveillance increases, patrols expand, laws tighten, public punishment becomes spectacle, not for cruelty's sake alone, but as policy. Control must be visible, uncertainty is dangerous. Jamaica follows a similar path, but at greater scale. Its size allows for expansion inland. Plantations push outward, so does violence. Resistance grows alongside production, answered with more force, more troops, more restrictions. Brutality is not random, it is standardized. Work routines are engineered to extract the maximum output before collapse. Cutting gangs move in coordinated lines. Boiling houses run without pause. Sleep is rationed. Rest is treated as theft. When bodies fail, they are discarded. Cuba enters this system later, but not gently. As other powers begin to question the sustainability of slavery, Spanish authorities double down. Sugar production expands with newer machinery and deeper capital investment. The logic remains unchanged. Technology does not reduce suffering, it increases efficiency. Saint-Domingue, present-day Haiti, becomes the extreme case. By the late 18th century, it is the most profitable colony on Earth. Sugar and coffee flow out in staggering volume. French wealth is tied directly to its fields. Paris tastes sweet because Saint-Domingue bleeds. The colony's success depends on constant importation of enslaved Africans. Death rates are so high that population growth cannot sustain itself. The system consumes faster than it reproduces. This creates an unstable reality, a society where the majority is brutalized, the minority is terrified, and profit depends on continuous violence. European observers know this, colonial administrators report it, planters complain privately, philosophers debate it from afar. But the money keeps moving. As long as ships arrive on time, the warnings are ignored. The plantation economy reshapes social life completely. There is no shared civic identity, no path to inclusion. Freedom exists only for a narrow class and only as long as control is maintained. Families are separated by sale. Language is fractured by design. Culture survives quietly in fragments under pressure. The system does not need the enslaved to forget who they are. It needs them too exhausted to act. Every island becomes a pressure vessel. The wealth leaving the Caribbean masks the instability beneath it. European cities see growth, not crisis. Banks expand credit based on future harvests, ports bustle, sugar futures are traded confidently. But the system has no margin for error. Any disruption threatens collapse. Weather, war, resistance, disease, there is no slack. Everything is optimized for extraction, not resilience. As the 18th century advances, the contradictions sharpen. Enlightenment ideas circulate in Europe, but they stop at the water's edge. Liberty is discussed in salons while bondage expands overseas. The gap between principle and practice grows wider. On the plantations, that gap is experienced as daily violence. Enslaved people understand the truth long before it is admitted by empire. They see that there is no reform coming, no gradual improvement, no reward for obedience beyond survival. The system offers no future. This realization spreads quietly, through whispered conversations, through stolen moments, through shared understanding shaped by suffering. Planters sense it. They increase repression. New laws criminalize assembly. Movement is restricted. Trust disappears. Even among the ruling class, suspicion grows. The plantation world is now locked in a deadly equilibrium. Profit demands ever greater output. Output demands ever harsher control. Control breeds resistance. Resistance invites terror. Terror deepens instability. By the late 1700s, Saint-Domingue stands at the center of this storm. Its wealth is unmatched. Its cruelty is routine. Its population is majority enslaved and newly arrived, with little to lose. The richest colony in the world is also the most brittle. Every harvest tightens the coil. Every shipment increases the stakes. Every act of punishment signals weakness rather than strength. The sugar empire has reached its peak. What comes next is not reform or adjustment, it is rupture. And in Saint-Domingue, the pressure finally breaks, pushing the system toward an explosion that will shake the Atlantic world and expose the true cost of profit built on human lives. Chapter 3. After the wealth is taken, when the sugar system breaks, it does not break quietly. In Saint-Domingue, the collapse is total. The plantation model that generated unmatched wealth is destroyed by the very people it consumed. The Haitian Revolution is not a reform of the sugar empire. It is its rejection. Fields burn. Mills fall silent. The most profitable colony on earth is remade through force and sacrifice. This moment terrifies every slaveholding power in the Atlantic. Haiti emerges free, but immediately punished. European powers isolate the new nation economically and diplomatically. Trade is restricted. Recognition is withheld. France demands compensation not for the enslaved, but for the former enslavers. Haiti is forced into a debt that will strangle its development for generations. The message is clear. Freedom will be allowed only at a cost designed to ensure it never threatens empire again. Elsewhere, the response is not liberation, but adjustment. Britain abolishes slavery in the early 19th century, but the structure of extraction remains intact. Enslavers are compensated generously. The formerly enslaved receive nothing. Land is not redistributed. Power does not shift. In Jamaica and Barbados, plantations transition to new labor systems that preserve elite control. Apprenticeship schemes bind freed people to estates. Wages are suppressed. Access to land is restricted. Dependency is rebuilt under a different name. The sugar fields remain. Ownership does not change. Barbados, already exhausted by centuries of monoculture, offers little alternative. Jamaica's interior holds potential, but land is locked behind legal and financial barriers. Freedom exists on paper, but survival still depends on plantation economies. Cuba takes a different path. Rather than retreat, sugar expands deeper into the 19th century. Backed by Spanish authority and foreign capital, production intensifies. New technology increases output. Enslaved labor continues longer than in neighboring colonies. Later, other coerced labor systems replace it. Cuba becomes one of the last strongholds of the sugar empire, proving that abolition does not automatically dismantle extraction. It only reshapes it. Across the Caribbean, the same pattern emerges. Political control shifts slightly. Legal language changes, but the economic architecture remains. Land concentration persists. Export dependence deepens. Local food systems stay weak. Infrastructure is designed for shipment, not community. The Caribbean enters modernity, already constrained. The wealth extracted during the sugar centuries does not disappear. It accumulates elsewhere. European banks, ports, insurance firms, and early industries are financed in part by Caribbean sugar profits. Capital moves forward cleanly. Its origins fade from view. The islands are left with the opposite legacy. Environmental damage limits diversification. Social divisions endure. Former enslaved populations are blamed for poverty created by the system that exploited them. Narratives of failure replace acknowledgement of theft. Even freedom is framed as burden. The sugar empire taught the world how to extract value at scale. It also taught the Caribbean how little protection it would receive once that value was gone. We need to understand this clearly. Underdevelopment is not a natural condition. It is the result of design. The Caribbean was engineered to produce wealth, not to retain it. When production ended or shifted, there was no plan for repair. This is the lasting consequence of the sugar system. Not just trauma, not just inequality, but a structural imbalance that survives abolition, survives empire, and shapes the present. By the mid-19th century, the chains are largely gone, but land ownership, trade patterns, and political power remain concentrated. Freedom arrives without tools. Citizenship arrives without leverage. The Caribbean is told to compete in a world it helped finance, starting from a position of deliberate disadvantage. This is the inheritance left behind. Sugar built empires. It also hollowed out the societies that fed them. When the profits moved on, the damage stayed. The story does not end here. But this is where the modern Caribbean stands at the threshold. Free in name, bound by structure, carrying the weight of a system designed to extract until nothing was left. The chains are gone. The design remains.